rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Smith, Judge Flory, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Today is Thursday, July 18th, 2019. We have six cases on our calendar for today, three of which are set for oral argument and three that are set for non-oral, our non-oral calendar. I believe also, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we do have some visitors from the International Visitor Leadership Program. And for those that have come to hear our oral arguments for today, we warmly welcome you to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and we hope you enjoy the couple of oral arguments that I believe you will be participating in. So, welcome. Our first case on today's calendar is A-19-0620 in the matter of the civil commitment of Christopher Raymond Coker. Is that the right pronunciation for his last name? Is it Coker?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
In the matter of Christopher Raymond Coker. Is that the correct pronunciation?
It is,
Your Honor. Okay, thank you. So, counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial opening arguments, followed by 15 minutes by a respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. There is a clock up there, so make sure you pay attention to that, and it'll warn you when you're getting down to the last few minutes. Also, the podium can be raised and lowered for your height to make it more convenient for you. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Marilyn Knudsen, K-N-U-D-S-E-N, and I am the attorney for Mr. Coker and have been the attorney for Mr. Coker for quite some many years. I have to say, just as a preliminary matter, this case, and in particular the posture of this case at this point, is fairly frustrating for me because I am used to, in my private practice, from which I've retired, done mostly divorces and some criminal. And there you have continuing jurisdiction and you have facts, particularly in divorces, that it's a change of circumstance and you get back into court. And it's mostly because it involves money and children. And I would really like it if there was some process that provided easier access for Mr. Coker to get into court and have review. And I know there's presumably maybe a 6002 motion that could be made, but that's been sort of rejected by the Supreme Court in these cases as well. It's particularly frustrating in this part because there have been so many changes in the evidence and the procedures since. And I don't want to belabor. I know that my motion for presenting the evidence has been rejected, but I do think if there's anyone intellectually curious, there is a wonderful Minnesota Law Review article about the theory of not presenting evidence at the appellate level. Mr. Coker has met his standards. The Supreme Court has established some facts that in their opinions, for example, there is no sexual deviancy. And that's specifically found in the no evidence of sexual deviancy. And that's been found in the 2016 Supreme Court decision. All that has been offered since then are statistical analyses that are done by the screeners, both of whom are consistent in their opinions and their rejections, and both of whom are hired by the commissioner. Dr. Obermeier is specifically paid by the commissioner to testify in this hearing in support of the commissioner's position. Dr. Marshall is not and has testified a lot. But each of them mentions, based on these records, these scales, these purely hypotheticals, sexual deviancy. And there is no evidence, probably since 2014, of any sexual deviancy. There is no...
Well, there's no record of any occurrence of any There's no record of him engaging in any
evidence of sexual deviancy that has occurred since then.
Right, but what we're talking about is the probability, the likelihood that he would engage, and particularly in relation to the fourth factor of protecting the public.
Surely. And the evidence is, of course, that the public has been very protected, and there are a couple of instances in the report, one of which is when he went into the library, and the librarian called the police, probably, we don't know why, not because of any behavior on his. I suspect maybe because he is a very dark African-American man, and she thought he had appeared on a poster or something. And the police came, and the police said, you know, you have a right to be here. And he said, no, I don't want to cause any trouble. I don't. If someone doesn't want me here, I won't be here. And then the other instance is the woman who testified at trial who had never met Mr. Coker. And he was able to empower her. It was a very moving, moving statement.
Counsel, can you point to any of the findings of the appeals panel that you're challenging as being clearly erroneous or not supported by the evidence that was presented at the hearing before the panel?
Well, I certainly think that there is no clear and convincing evidence of sexual deviance. I can look at the...
Well, I'm asking the question because as I review your memorandum, I understand the points of law that you're making, but I didn't see where those points of law were tied to specific findings where you thought the panel had erred in making their findings that weren't sustained by the evidence that was presented. And so I'm giving you the opportunity to point me to those specific findings that you're challenging as erroneous.
Ah, thank you. And if you'll just give me a moment to review the specific. Order. Certainly, I would find that Ms. Thelman, any of Ms. Thelman's testimony as to any sort of, which did not produce any signs of dangerousness, that
But her testimony more went to what level he was at.
I'm sorry?
Her testimony went more to what level he was at and that he was stagnant in
right,
level
but two. That is just an arbitrary figure that they apply to him. She didn't testify to any behavior that presented any sort of dangerousness. But
the absence of that testimony, going to Judge Fleury's question, what specific finding by the CAP is clearly erroneous?
Take finding 52, that there are no conditions exist to provide a reasonable protection. There is nothing to show that he doesn't have a reasonable degree of protection. He has to report. His family testified. He has been used as a model to go to the other facilities. He helped this woman he empowered this woman. The expert testimony.
Well, but to that finding number 52,
yes.
the CAP actually recognized the support of his family. It wasn't as if they completely disregarded that.
No.
They did take that into account, but they said even given that, a strong support network, that no condition exists to provide a reasonable degree of protection to the public.
They're again saying the degree of danger, that's based on the degree of danger that he presents. And there's no evidence of any danger.
Well, the no analysis danger. from the statistical models, and the statistical models which have been used consistently show that he rates in the very high level of recidivism. Of the likelihood of engaging in
on the scales,
correct. But in addition to the progress or the lack of progress that he's been able to make. I mean, the CAP certainly acknowledges the progress that he's made, but they note that he hasn't made enough sufficient progress to move to the next level.
But the next level is really discharge.
Full discharge, correct.
Full discharge.
Right, and they point to the fact, both the doctors point to the fact that he received a score of 6 on the static, was it static 99R, which shows a level 4B, which is well above average, and is the high risk for sexual reoffense than typical offenders.
But high risk is not clear and convincing evidence. I argue that clear and convincing standard is a very high standard and very close to proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, but you argue in your brief that the standard actually should be beyond a reasonable doubt, and that is not the standard. The standard is clear and convincing evidence.
Almost. I'm citing the Microsoft case by the United States Supreme Court. There is very little distinction between clear and convincing evidence. It was a patent case. How often do I get to do a patent case?
I used to do patent law, so I like that site.
Okay. But it was a very high standard, and it was very close. It's very close, and they say that it's all that they really can't distinguish between clear and convincing and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a patent case.
True.
With all deference to patents, this is a more fundamental question.
True, but there is a difference between clear and convincing and beyond a reasonable doubt.
I define a definition of that. I think they are that similar. And particularly here where liberty instead of patents is involved.
So one of the things that I'm struggling with, quite frankly, is the our standard of review.
Yes.
So as long as there's evidence in the record to support the CAP's decision, it doesn't matter if there might be reasonable inferences to the contrary. And it sounds like you're arguing that there could be inferences to the contrary based on family support, based on the progress that he's made, and he certainly has made a lot of progress, no question about that. But what we're talking about here is whether he is ready for a full discharge based on the factors that the CAP has to consider. As long as there's evidence in the record to support the CAP's decision, we defer to that then. So I go back to what are the findings? What's the evidence in the record that shows that CAP's
did not
meet the clear and convincing evidence standard?
I think that all of the expert testimony is not clear and convincing evidence. What it is generic evidence of testing.
Let me ask you this question, because I think you raise an interesting point. Do you see any situation where the expert testimony, in your opinion, would be enough to sustain or to meet this clear and convincing evidence standard?
If there was some behavior to support it, but there is nothing to say. So
broadly speaking, you think that testimony and statistical analyses are not enough to support it by experts?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it would never apply. It would never be enough in any situation.
Well, if you had a statistical probability that was 89-90%, then it might be relevant. But where you've got 25% of the people, or some lower, that he's in a group and 25% of them are going to reoffend, that's not clear and convincing evidence. And so I do think that they rely on these experts, and the experts are not fortune tellers. And they're only putting the respondent into a category of people, and we don't know really whether or not he fits into that category.
But here the panel heard testimony from all three experts that your client is diagnosed as suffering from, a sexual paraphilic disorder, which is a recognized diagnosis, and that he hasn't completed treatment. Even his primary treatment provider says he has not completed his sexual offender treatment.
Which,
how did the panel err by relying on that evidence?
Well, first of all, that doesn't make him in the 99th percentile or the 89th percentile or anything. Second of all, there's no showing that treatment can't be completed. Most of the people, hardly any of the people at Pathfinders are committed. Pathfinders is a community program. He goes there on the bus by himself. He checks in by himself. I think he stops at McDonald's and gets a hamburger, and then he comes back. Dr. Goldsmith was quite supportive of his being discharged and continuing with the program.
He didn't express an opinion, as I read the record, on discharge.
He didn't, but he said that Mr. Coker could continue with the program.
Should he choose to voluntarily do that?
Yes. And we have no reason to think that Mr. Coker won't choose to voluntarily do all sorts of productive things.
Well, he hasn't voluntarily gotten into a different type of housing program.
Well, I'm not being allowed to talk about that, but I'd be real happy to talk about it.
Well, I mean, they made findings that...
They did.
And those that was the evidence at the time.
Those findings are not currently accurate. I don't mean to belabor that, but they're not currently accurate. And if...
Were they accurate at the time the panel made them?
Well, no, because actually the program that they were proposing was not suitable for Mr. Coker. And I think that's been resolved now. But I mean, there is just some critical evidence out there that I do think should be delivered. And I know that it's judicial efficiency, but I think it'd be more judicially official to hear the new evidence and be done with it than go through all this belabored process that we're going through.
Thank you, Mr. Newsom. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Anthony Noss, Assistant Attorney General, and I'm here today representing the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Your Honors, the Commissioner respectfully requests that this court affirm the Commitment Appeal Panel's order denying Mr. Coker's petition for discharge from civil commitment. The standard of review here, as I believe Your Honor pointed out, is in part that this court applies a clear error standard of review to a Commitment Appeal Panel's findings of fact by examining the record to determine whether the evidence sustains the panel's findings. In so doing, this court does not reweigh the evidence, and it is immaterial that the record might also provide a reasonable basis for inferences and findings to the contrary. Then this court reviews de novo questions of statutory interpretation and the statutory construction and the application of statutory criteria to the facts found. First, the panel correctly concluded that the commissioner in Hennepin County proved by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Coker's petition for discharge from civil commitment should be denied. Second, and this really wasn't brought up much today, but Mr. Coker's constitutional claims are barred by collateral estoppel, and in the alternative, they've all been rejected by Minnesota's appellate courts and the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Well, how are they barred by collateral estoppel when one of them is an as-applied claim, and has he ever brought an as-applied claim in federal court?
Your Honor, I believe the respondent addresses that in respondent's brief. If I could just look for a moment. Your Honor, in the collateral estoppel argument in respondent's brief, there's a discussion for the first and second issues of the collateral estoppel prongs where respondent does discuss how the Karsgens matter involved a facial and as-applied challenge to the Minnesota Commitment and Treatment Act.
Right, but was he, as an individual, was he a party to the Karsgens case? Or did he ever bring a separate challenge in federal court?
Your Honor, I'm not aware that Mr. Coker brought a challenge as an individual, an as-applied challenge to the Commitment and Treatment Act, but as the respondent's brief discusses, Mr. Coker is part of the class.
Well, if he's part of the class, then I think there might be a colorable argument that he would be covered by the facial challenge, but the as-applied is to the individual, and it would have to relate to an individual claim. Well, in any event, let's go back to the, I think more the main issue is the commitment and the denial by the CAP. How does just relying on statistical analyses, how does that meet the clear and convincing evidence standard? And I mean, in particular, in this case, there's nothing on the record indicating that he has engaged in any type of inappropriate behavior.
Your Honor, I believe, as Your Honor pointed out when Mr. Coker was arguing, the inquiry here isn't whether there has been, I think Mr. Coker's counsel described it as evidence of sexual deviancy. I take that to mean that counsel is talking about, has he raped someone? Has he sexually assaulted someone? That's not the inquiry that the CAP or this court is looking at. One of the prongs under Colby Gomez is whether the individual remains dangerous to the public. It's more
okay,
than just...
Okay, so what evidence is there that he is indeed dangerous to the public?
Your Honor, there is the, I think, what's been referred to by counsel as statistical evidence. Their respondent's brief goes through in depth about the static 99R, the stable 2007, and other actuarial tools. So there is that factual evidence on where he ended up based on the experts.
Well, is that factual evidence or is that really just hypotheses, conjecture?
That is factual evidence,
of
Your Honor.
Of what he might do.
Well, the inquiry is, Your Honor, prospective in nature. We're looking at is there a danger that does he pose a danger to the public by potentially being someone who could offend against the public? Here, it's important to also note that the evidence in support of discharge goes beyond just some scores on actuarial tools.
But the CAP relied fairly heavily on expert testimony. There were three experts that testified for the commissioner and three people who testified for our appellant. And in particular, the two doctors were, their testimony was heavily cited by the CAP.
Yes, Your Honor, and a case that may be helpful here is Addington v. Texas by the Supreme Court. In that case, the Supreme Court discussed how critical expert opinions are in civil commitment proceedings, and the court noted that that factual aspects represent only the beginning. And then the court went on to essentially say that the ultimate questions about dangerousness and the need for treatment turn on the meaning of the facts, which must be interpreted by experts. So here we have sort of these facts of things that he's done, of the scores that he has in the actuarial tools, but the commissioner's evidence went beyond that. There was interpretive and analytical testimony and evidence in the reports about what these things meant in terms of the continued need for treatment and supervision for a sexual disorder and the risk of dangerousness to the public. So the point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is that the commissioner didn't just go to the CAP and put forth some scores and actuarial tools. There was in-depth testimony from, at a minimum, Dr. Obermeier and Dr. Marshall about what that meant in terms of why is he still dangerous? Why does he still need treatment and supervision for a sexual disorder? So Mr. Coker is leading the court astray if he's asserting that all the commissioner did was put forth some statistical numbers, because that's just not the case.
No, but that goes to one of the key factors that needs to be analyzed in terms of the danger to the public. And the commissioner needs to prove each factor by clear and convincing evidence. And the danger to the public, it seems that if you, it almost seems like, you know, to refer to an older movie that I think popped into my head thinking about this is The Minority Report, Steven Spielberg movie, where they're arresting people on the possibility that they may engage in a crime. And so when you've got somebody here and the opinion by Dr. Obermeier and Dr. Marshall are that he is likely to engage because based on these statistical analyses, these models, but he's put in the 25% category. And if he's put roughly in the 25% category, how does that meet clear and convincing when if even by preponderance of the evidence is over 50% and clear and convincing evidence is higher than that, where it falls, it's somewhere between that and beyond a reasonable doubt. How does that reach that clear and convincing evidence level to show that he is indeed a danger to the public?
Your Honor, even assuming that we were looking at some sort of percentage-based analysis for the clear and convincing standard, the scores on the actuarial tools isn't the end of the evidence, and it's also not the end of a court's proper inquiry into this the dangerousness factor. Importantly, the commissioner also has a large extent of evidence that relates to, I think it's described in the commissioner's brief as relating to dynamic need areas or dynamic risk, which is more of an analysis of looking at specific risk factors, things that were a problem for Mr. Coker that led to his offending, things that continue to be risk factors for him based on the record. So the point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is that the evidence is not just the statistical scores. It goes beyond that with analysis of dynamic risk. So the evidence needs to be looked at in its totality, and there is clear and convincing evidence if the court looks at all those forms of evidence, and it shouldn't just look at the actuarial scores. Notably, as I think Your Honor pointed out, on the static 99R, for example, although I think there was some sort of 20.5% actuarial score related to his Mr. Coker's score, Dr. Obermeier did point out that he is in the highest level for that actuarial tool, level 4B or well above average risk, which she testified is the, quote, highest level.
So let me ask you this then. I mean, I think obviously if you look at the history of the position that the commissioner has taken on discharge from these civil commitments, there's been very few people who have ever been recommended for discharge. And only until perhaps the Carstens case shed more light on this have we seen some more. So my question for you then from the commissioner's perspective is, what is lacking here for Mr. Coker? What would he need to accomplish from the commissioner's perspective in order to for the commissioner to agree that he should be fully discharged?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer of that question from the commissioner. I don't know the answer from the commissioner. I can say that answering that question would be speculative and very difficult, in large part because, as that Addington v. Texas case discussed, the inquiry before the court in these civil commitment proceedings is not just, here's a fact, he has one part of treatment left instead of two or four. You know, he now lives here, and that would be good enough. That Addington case really discusses how the meaning of those facts viewed through the eyes and the analysis of the experts is what properly guides a court. So I don't know the answer from the commissioner's perspective, Your Honor, and I don't know that question really could properly be answered at this point.
Well, does Mr. Coker know what he would need to do? I mean, I guess I'm asking it somewhat rhetorically, but he's got a horrible history dating back many, many years ago, and I would suspect that these statistical tests are going to take that into consideration, and he may always be in some level of risk to reoffend just because of the nature of the conduct that's brought him into the prison system, into the commitment system to begin with. So I think to Judge Reyes's point, I mean, we can't rely only on the statistics. And I think we have to look at how he's done in treatment, and we have to look at what's brought him into the system to begin with. That's all fair. But on the other hand, he has to know what he has to accomplish to achieve what the commissioner expects him to achieve. And it can't just be based on statistics.
And Your Honor, again, I cannot say what exact facts would make the commissioner not oppose Mr. Coker's discharge. But insofar as the court is apparently concerned about fairness to Mr. Coker, how is he supposed to know how he can improve to get discharge, I would imagine that perhaps if he were to review the CAP's order, he may be able to discern some concerns that the CAP had, at the very least. Finally, Your Honors, there was also the first call prong. I won't go through the whole legal standard. It's in the commissioner's brief, but the court does view the statute, the discharge standard, through the lens of the Colby Gomez case. The commissioner has proven by clear and convincing evidence that the panel correctly, or that Mr. Coker continues to need treatment and supervision for a sexual disorder, and that he remains dangerous to the public. It's quite telling today, Your Honors, when Mr. Coker was pressed to find and highlight factual findings that were clearly erroneous or other errors. And there really wasn't anything of substance brought up by Mr. Coker. Nothing that comes even remotely close to determining that the panel clearly erred or that the panel erred in denying the petition for discharge. So based on that and the reasons in the commissioner's brief, the commissioner would respectfully request that this court affirm the commitment appeal panel's order denying Mr. Coker's discharge request. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
The first thing I would like to address is whether Mr. Coker has preserved his issues, his constitutional issues. And I would point out that clearly the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that he does. And the way he got into his present situation was by relying on facts which let them not have to address the constitutional issues. So those constitutional issues remain legitimate for Mr. Coker and, in fact, have been preserved by Coker v. Jessen. It's a very good point that nobody knows what it is he has to do. And in fact, again, it's just so tempting when you know that the things are different now and that Mr. Coker seems to know quite well what he has to do and is doing it. And
what about successful discharge from treatment?
I'm sorry, what?
It would seem to me one thing he should know that he needs to do is a successful discharge from treatment.
Absolutely, and I suspect that will happen in August. Mm-hmm. That he is well, and I think Dr. Goldsmith testified that he's on his way. He doesn't have much more to do. He'll be in an aftercare program, but he's not in residential treatment even now. He doesn't need residential treatment. He's not refusing the treatment. He likes the treatment, and he has a good rapport with Dr. Goldsmith, who is treating him. Frankly, the reason that we can't point to specific findings of fact that are not sustained is that none of the findings of fact have been sustained. He is not dangerous. I suppose some of the preliminary ones that when he was indeterminately committed, he was committed for his last offense was committed in 1992. And then the procedural matters are not contended. The factual matters of his crimes are not in contention, but they were in 1991 and 1992. He has not done anything criminal, has not violated, has declined some of the terms that they offer, but has not violated any of the provisions that have been required of him.
Well, I don't think that's in dispute. I don't think that's the question. Sure. This isn't somebody who relapses, so to speak,
yes,
and has made taken steps backward. I think the issue here more is different than and a little bit unusual in the sense it's more he's made significant progress. He made it through phase one. He proved a prima facie case. And now the question is whether or not the commissioner's met the clear and convincing evidence standard. And the testimony seems to be that at this point, at least in this point in time, when the CAP reviewed it and we're limited to the record of what was before the CAP,
yeah,
is that he was stagnant at that point in time. And so that's really the lens that we're looking at. And it seems like there's a lot of evidence in the record to show that at least at that point, he wasn't moving backward, but he wasn't moving forward enough to show that he was ready for a full discharge.
But he was moving forward. They were trying to get him out of where he was living.
Right.
They were trying to get him to be make enough money to be independent. He said that he didn't want to do that until he had a job that would support him. I mean, he had reasons for what he was doing.
Right, and the CAP took those into consideration.
I'm sorry?
It looks like the CAP took those into consideration in its analysis as well.
And that there was no sexual deviancy. He's progressed through many phases of, he has a very close-knit family that's willing to support him, and the family background and what the forces that they're going to apply on them sort of countermand any of the concerns that he won't continue. They will have him continue and get more involved, and there's nothing that refutes that this family is a very supportive family, a very law-abiding family, a family involved in restorative justice. They found a job for him. He goes to St. Cloud every other weekend or so with his fiance. Demonstrates, he said he was, and there has been no sexual deviancy to be treated. You know, you aren't really treating the sexual deviancy in this matter. So that's was a finding of the Supreme Court in the last time we were up at the Supreme Court. So for all of those reasons, I would submit that the decision by the statutorily created appeal panel should not be sustained. It should be reversed, and he should be allowed to go ahead with what he wants to do, which is maintain a job that supports him and live in the community with his family support. Thank you.
Thank you both. We appreciate the arguments by both counsel. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you.